They have taken to hunting game on a massive scale, killing everything in the forest and doing a typically rotten job of butchering and preserving the meat. Our own hunters come back disgusted over the waste, often having been shot at without provocation. I know it's a lot to ask, but when you can spare a platoon from relocation riot duty, could you send them up here to help us root out these self-centered, hoarding, romantic scoundrels from their little filtered armories? Maybe a unit or two of the U.S. Army will convince them that we won the war and have to cooperate with each other from now on. He put the letter down. So it had been that way here, too. The cliched last straw had been this plague of survivalists, particularly those following the high priest of violent anarchy, Nathan Holm. One of Gordon's duties in the militia had been to help weed out some of those small gangs of city-bred cutthroats and gun nuts. The number of fortified caves and cabins his unit had found in the prairie and on little lake islands had been staggering, all set up in a rush of paranoia in the difficult decades before the war. The irony of it was that we had things turned around. The Depression was over. People were at work again and cooperating. Except for a few crazies, it looked like a renaissance was coming, for America and for the world. But we forgot just how much harm a few crazies could do, in America and in the world. Of course, when the collapse did come, the solitary survivalists' precious little fortresses did not stay theirs for long. Most of the tiny bastions changed hands a dozen or more times in the first months. They were such tempting targets. The battles had raged all over the plains until every solar collector was shattered, every windmill wrecked, and every cache of valuable medicines scattered in the never-ending search for heavy dope. Only the ranches and villages, those possessing the right mixture of ruthlessness, internal cohesion, and common sense, survived in the end. By the time the guard units had all died at their posts, or themselves dissolved into roving gangs of battling survivalists, very few of the original population of armed and armored hermits remained alive. Gordon looked at the letter's postmark again. Nearly 2 years after the war. He shook his head. I never knew anyone held on so long. The thought hurt like a dull wound inside him. Anything that made the last 16 years seem avoidable was just too hard to imagine. There was a faint sound. Gordon looked up, wondering if he had imagined it. Then, only slightly louder, another faint knock rapped at the door to his room. Come in, he called. The door opened about halfway. Abby, the petite girl with the vaguely oriental cast to her eyes, smiled timidly from the opening. Gordon refolded the letter and slipped it into its envelope. He smiled. Hello, Abby. What's up?
I've come to ask if there is anything else you needed, she said a little quickly. Did you enjoy your bath?
Did I now?
Gordon sighed. He found himself slipping back into Macduff's burr.
Aye, lass. And in particular, I appreciated the gift of that toothbrush. Haven't sent it was.
You mentioned you'd lost yours.
She looked at the floor.
I pointed out that we had at least 5 or 6 unused ones in the storage room. I'm glad you were pleased.
It was your idea, he bowed. Then I am indeed in your debt.
Abby looked up and smiled.
Was that a letter you were just reading? Could I look at it? I've never seen a letter before.
Gordon laughed.
Surely you're not that young. What about before the war?
Abby blushed at his laughter.
I was only 4 when it happened. It was so frightening and confusing that I really don't remember much from before.
Gordon blinked. Had it really been that long? Yes. 16 years was indeed enough time to have beautiful women in the world who knew nothing but the Dark Age.
Amazing, he thought.
All right, then.
He pushed the chair by his bed. Grinning, she came over and sat beside him. Gordon reached into the sack and pulled out another of the frail, yellowed envelopes. Carefully, he spread out the letter and handed it to her. Abby looked at it so intently that he thought she was reading the whole thing. She concentrated, her thin eyebrows almost coming together in a crease on her forehead. But finally she handed the letter back.
I guess I can't really read that well. I mean, I can read labels on cans and stuff, but I never had much practice with handwriting and sentences.
Her voice dropped at the end. She sounded embarrassed, but in a totally unafraid, trusting fashion, as if he were her confessor. He smiled. No matter. I'll tell you what it's about. He held the letter up to the candlelight. Abby moved over to sit by his knees on the edge of the bed, her eyes rapt on the pages. It's from one John Briggs of Fort Rock, Oregon, to his former employer in Klamath Falls. I guess from the lathe and hobby horse letterhead that Briggs was a retired machinist or carpenter or something. Gordon concentrated on the barely legible handwriting. It seems Mr. Briggs is a pretty nice man. Here he's offering to take in his ex-boss's children until the emergency is over. Also, he says he has a good garage machine shop, his own power, and plenty of metal stock. He wants to know if the man wants to order any parts made up, especially things in short supply. Gordon's voice faltered. He was still so thick-headed from his excesses that it had just struck him that a beautiful female was sitting on his bed. The depression she made in the mattress tilted his body toward her. He cleared his throat quickly and went back to scanning the letter. Briggs mentioned something about power levels from the Fort Rock Reservoir. Telephones were out, but he was still, oddly enough, getting Eugene on his computer data net. Abby looked at him. Apparently, much of what he had said about the letter writer might as well have been in a foreign language to her. Machine shop and data net could have been ancient, magical words of power.
Why didn't you bring us any letters here in Pineview?
She asked quite suddenly. Gordon blinked at the non-sequitur. The girl wasn't stupid. One could tell such things. Then why had everything he said, when he arrived here and later at the party, been completely misunderstood? She still thought he was a mailman, as apparently did all but a few of the others in this small settlement. From whom did she imagine they'd get mail? She probably didn't realize that the letters he carried had been sent long ago from dead men and women to other dead men and women, or that he carried them for his own reasons. The myth that had spontaneously developed here in Pineview depressed Gordon. It was one more sign of the deterioration of civilized minds, many of whom had once been high school and even college graduates. He considered telling her the truth, as brutally and frankly as he could, to stop this fantasy once and for all. He started to. There aren't any letters because... He paused. Again, Gordon was aware of her nearness, the scent of her and the gentle curves of her body, of her trust as well. He sighed and looked away. There aren't any letters for you folks because I'm coming west out of Idaho and nobody back there knows you here in Pine View. From here I'm going to the coast. There might even be some large towns left. Maybe
somebody down there will write to us if we send them a letter first.
Abby's eyes were bright.
Then, when you pass this way again on your way back to Idaho, you could give us the letters they send and maybe do another play act for us like tonight, and we'll have so much beer and pie for you, you'll bust.
She hopped a little on the edge of the bed.
By then I'll be able to read better, I promise.
Gordon shook his head and smiled. It was beyond his right to dash such dreams. Maybe so, Abby. Maybe so. But you know, you may get to learn to read easier than that. Mrs. Thompson's offered to put it up for a vote to let me stay on here for a while. I guess officially I'd be school teacher, so I'd have to prove myself as good a hunter and farmer as anybody. I could give archery lessons. He stopped. Abby's expression was open-mouthed in surprise. She shook her head vigorously.
But you haven't heard. They voted on it after you went to take your bath. Mrs. Thompson should be ashamed of trying to bribe a man like you that way, with your important work having to be done.
He sat forward, not believing his ears. What did you say? He had formed hopes of staying in Pine View for at least the cold season, maybe a year or more. Who could tell? Perhaps the wanderlust would leave him, and he could finally find a home. His sated stupor dissipated. Gordon fought to hold back his anger. To have the chance revoked on the basis of the crowd's childish fantasies? Abby noticed his agitation and hurried on.
That wasn't the only reason, of course. There was the problem of there being no woman for you. And then...
Her voice lowered perceptibly.
And then Mrs. Howlett thought you'd be perfect for helping me and Michael finally have a baby.
Gordon blinked. He said, expressing the sudden and complete contents of his mind.
We've been trying for 5 years, she explained. Really want children. But Mr. Horton thinks Michael can't because he had the mumps really bad when he was 12. You remember the real bad mumps, don't you?
Gordon nodded, recalling friends who had died. The resultant sterility had made for unusual social arrangements everywhere he had traveled.
Still,
Abby went on quickly.
Well, it would cause problems if we asked any of the other men here to be the body father. I mean, when you live close to people like this, you have to look on the men who aren't your husband as not being really men. At least not that way. I don't think I'd like it, and it might cause trouble.
She blushed.
Besides, I'll tell you something if you promise to keep a secret. I don't think any of the other men would be able to give Michael the kind of son he deserves. He's really very smart, you know. He's the only one of us youngers who can really read.
The flow of strange logic was coming on too fast for Gordon to follow completely. Part of him dispassionately noted that this was all really an intricate and subtle tribal adaptation to a difficult social problem. That part of him, though, the last 20th century intellectual, was still a bit drunk, and meanwhile the rest was starting to realize what Abby was driving at.
You're different,
she smiled at him.
I mean, even Michael saw that right from the start. He's not too happy, but he figures you'll only be through once a year or so, and he could stand that. He'd rather that than never have any kids.
Gordon cleared his throat.
Yeah. You sure he feels this way?
Oh, yes. Why do you think Mrs. Howlett introduced us in that funny way? It was to make it clear without really saying it out loud. Mrs. Thompson doesn't like it much, but I think that's because she wanted you to stay.
Gordon's mouth felt dry. How do you feel about all this? Her expression was enough of an answer. She looked at him as if he were some sort of visiting prophet, or at least the hero out of a storybook.
I'd be honored if you'd say yes,
she said quietly, and lowered her eyes. And you'd be able to think of me as a man? That way? Abby grinned. She answered by crawling up on top of him and planting her mouth intensely upon his. There was a momentary pause as she shimmied out of her clothes, and Gordon turned to snuff out the candles on the bedstand. Beside them lay the letterman's gray uniform cap, its brass badge casting multiple reflections of the dancing flames. The figure of a rider, hunched forward on horseback before bulging saddlebags, seemed to move at a flickering gallop.
This is another one I owe you, Mr. Postman.
Abby's smooth skin slid along his side. Her hand slipped into his as he took a deep breath and blew the candles out. 6. For 10 days, Gordon's life followed a new pattern. As if to catch up on 6 months' road weariness, he slept late each morning and awoke to find Abby gone, like the night's dreams. Yet her warmth and scent lingered on the sheets when he stretched and opened his eyes. The sunshine streaming through his eastward-facing window was like something new, a springtime in his heart, and not really early autumn at all. He rarely saw her during the day as he washed and helped with chores until noon, chopping and stacking wood for the community supply and digging a deep pit for a new outhouse. When most of the village gathered for the main meal of the day, Abby returned from tending the flocks, but she spent lunchtime with the younger children, relieving old, one-legged Mr. Lowes, their work supervisor. The little ones laughed as she kidded them, plucking the wool that coated their clothes from a morning spent carding skeins for the winter spinning, helping them keep the gray strands out of their food. She barely glanced at Gordon, but that brief smile was enough. He knew he had no rights beyond these few days, and yet a shared look in the daylight made him feel that it was all real and not just a dream. Afternoons, he conferred with Mrs. Thompson and the other village leaders, helping them inventory books and other long-neglected salvage. At intervals, he gave reading and archery lessons. One day, he and Mrs. Thompson traded methods in the art of field medicine while treating a man clawed by a tiger what the locals called that new strain of mountain lion which had bred with leopards escaped from zoos in the post-war chaos. The trapper had surprised the beast with its kill, but fortunately, it had only batted him into the brush and let him run away. Gordon and the village matriarch felt sure the wound would heal. In the evenings, all of Pineview gathered in the big garage, and Gordon recited stories by Twain and Sales and Keeler. He led them in singing old folk songs and lovingly remembered commercial jingles and in playing Remember When. Then it was time for drama. Dressed in scrap and foil, he was John Paul Jones, shouting defiance from the deck of the Bonhomme Richard. He was Anton Perceval, exploring the dangers of a faraway world and the depths of his own potential with a mad robot companion. And he was Dr. Hudson, wading through the horror of the Kenyan conflict to treat the victims of biological war. At first, Gordon always felt uneasy, putting on a flimsy costume and stomping across the makeshift stage, waving his arms, shouting lines only vaguely recalled or made up on the spot. He had never really admired play acting as a profession, even before the Great War. But it had got him halfway across the continent, and he was good at it. He felt the rapt gaze of the audience, their hunger for wonder and something of the world beyond their narrow valley, and their eagerness warmed him to the task. Pox-scarred and wounded, bent from year after year of back-breaking labor merely to survive, they looked up, the need greatest in eyes clouded with age, a yearning for help doing what they could no longer accomplish alone, remembering. Wrapped in his rolls, he gave them bits and pieces of lost romance, and by the time the last lines of his soliloquy faded, he too was able to forget the present, at least for a while. Each night, after he retired, she came to him. For a while she would sit on the edge of his bed and talk of her life, about the flocks and the village children and Michael. She brought him books to ask their meanings and questioned him about his youth, about the life of a student in the wonderful days before the Doom War. Then, after a time, Abby would smile, put away the dusty volumes, and slide under the covers next to him while he leaned over and took care of the candle. On the tenth morning, she did not slip away with the pre-dawn light, but instead wakened Gordon with a kiss.
Good morning, he commented, and reached for her.
But Abby pulled away. She picked up her clothes, brushing her breasts across the soft hairs of his flat stomach.
I should let you sleep, she told him, but I wanted to ask you something.
She held her dress in a ball.
What is it?
Gordon stuffed the pillow behind his head for support.
You're going to be leaving today, aren't you?
She asked.
Yes, he nodded seriously.
It's probably best. I'd like to stay longer, but since I can't, I'd better be heading west again.
I know,
she nodded seriously.
We'll all hate to see you go, but, well, I'm going to meet Michael out at the trap line this evening. I miss him terribly.
She touched the side of his face.
That doesn't bother you, does it? I mean, it's been wonderful here with you, but he's my husband, and...
He smiled and covered her hand. To his amazement, he had little difficulty with his feelings. He was more envious than jealous of Michael. The desperate logic of their desire for children and their obvious love for one another made the situation, in retrospect, as obvious as the need for a clean break at the end. He only hoped he had done them the favor they sought, for despite their fantasies, it was unlikely he would ever come this way again.
I have something for you,
Abby said. She reached under the bed and pulled out a small, silvery object on a chain and a paper package.
It's a whistle. Mrs. Howlett says you should have one.
She slipped it over his neck and adjusted it until satisfied with the effect.
Also, she helped me write this letter.
Abby picked up the little package.
I found some stamps in a drawer in the gas station, but they wouldn't stick on. So I got some money instead. This is $14. Will it be enough?
She held out a cluster of faded bills. Gordon couldn't help smiling. Yesterday, 5 or 6 of the others had privately approached him. He had accepted their little envelopes and similar payments for postage with as straight a face as possible. He might have used the opportunity to charge them something he needed, but the community had already given him a month's stock of jerky, dried apples, and 20 straight arrows for his bow. There was no need, nor had he the desire to extort anything else. Some of the older citizens had had relatives in Eugene or Portland or towns in the Willamette Valley. It was the direction he was heading, so he took the letters. A few were addressed to people who had lived in Oak Ridge and Blue River. Those he filed deep in the safest part of his sack. The rest he might as well throw into Crater Lake for all the good they would ever do, but he pretended anyway. He soberly counted out a few paper bills, then handed back the rest of the worthless currency.
And, who are you writing to?
Gordon asked Abby as he took the letter. He felt as if he were playing Santa Claus and found himself enjoying it.
I'm writing to the university, you know, at Eugene. I asked a bunch of questions like, are they taking new students again yet? And do they take married students?
Abby blushed.
I know I'd have to work real hard on my reading to get good enough, and maybe they aren't recovered enough to take many new students. But Michael's already so smart, and by the time we hear from them, maybe things will be better.
By the time you hear. Gordon shook his head. Abby nodded.
I'll for sure be reading a lot better by then. Mrs. Thompson promises she'll help me, and her husband has agreed to start a school this winter. I'm going to help with the little kids. I hope maybe I can learn to be a teacher. Do you think that's silly?
Gordon shook his head. He had thought himself beyond surprise, but this touched him. In spite of Abby's totally disproportioned view of the state of the world, her hope warmed him, and he found himself dreaming along with her. There was no harm in wishing, was there?
Actually,
Abby went on confidentially, twisting her dress in her hands,
one of the big reasons I'm writing is to get a pen pal. That's the word, isn't it? I'm hoping maybe someone in Eugene will write to me. That way, we'll get letters here. I'd love to get a letter. Also,
her gaze fell.
That will give you another reason to come back in a year or so, besides maybe wanting to see the baby.
She looked up and dimpled.
I got the idea from your Sherlock Holmes play. That's an ulterior motive, isn't it?
She was so delighted with her own cleverness and so eager for his approval, Gordon felt a great, almost painful rush of tenderness. Tears welled as he reached out and pulled her into an embrace. He held her tightly and rocked slowly, his eyes shut against reality, and he breathed in with her sweet smell a light and optimism he had thought gone from the world. 7.
Well, this is where I turn back.
Mrs. Thompson shook hands with Gordon.
Down this road, things should be pretty tame until you get to Davis Lake. The last of the old loner survivalists that way wiped each other out some years back, though I'd still be careful if I were you.
There was a chill in the air, for autumn had arrived in full. Gordon zipped up the old letter carrier's jacket and adjusted the leather bag as the straight-backed old woman handed him an old road map.
I had Jimmy Horton mark the places we know of where homesteaders have set up. I wouldn't bother any of them unless you have to. Mostly they're a suspicious type, likely to shoot first. We've only been trading with the nearest for a short time.
Gordon nodded. He folded the map carefully and slipped it into a pouch. He felt rested and ready. He would regret leaving Pine View as much as any haven in recent memory. But now that he was resigned to going, he actually felt a growing eagerness to be traveling, to see what had happened in the rest of Oregon. In the years since he had left the wreckage of Minnesota, he had found ever wilder signs of the Dark Age. But now he was in a new watershed. This had once been a pleasant state, with dispersed light industry, productive farms, and an elevated level of culture. Perhaps it was merely Abby's innocence infecting him. But logically, the Willamette Valley would be the place to look for civilization, if it existed anywhere anymore. He took the old woman's hand once again.
Mrs. Thompson, I'm not sure I could ever repay what you people have done for me.
She shook her head. Her face was deeply tanned, and so wrinkled Gordon was certain she had to be more than the 50 years she claimed.
No, Gordon, you paid your keep. I would have liked it if you could have stayed and helped me get the school going. But now I see maybe it won't be so hard to do it by ourselves.
She gazed out over her little valley.
You know, we've been living in a kind of daze these last years since the crops have started coming in and the hunting's returned. You can tell how bad things have gotten when a bunch of grown men and women who once had jobs, who read magazines and filled out their own taxes, for heaven's sake, start treating a poor, battered, wandering play actor as if he was something like the Easter Bunny.
She looked back at him.
Even Jim Horton gave you a couple of letters to deliver, didn't he?
Gordon's face felt hot. For a moment he was too embarrassed to face her. Then, all at once, he burst out laughing. He wiped his eyes in relief at having the group fantasy lifted from his shoulders. Mrs. Thompson chuckled as well.
Oh, it was harmless, I think. And more than that, you've served as a... You know, that old automobile thing? A catalyst, I think. You know, the children are already exploring ruins for miles around between chores and supper, bringing me all the books they find. I won't have any trouble making school into a privilege. Imagine punishing them by suspending them from class. I hope Bobby and I handle it right.
I wish you the best of luck, Mrs. Thompson, Gordon said sincerely. God, it would be nice to see a light somewhere in all this desolation.
Right, son. That'd be bliss.
Mrs. Thompson sighed.
I'd recommend you wait a year, but come on back. You're kind. You treated my people well. And you're discreet about some things, like that business with Abby and Michael.
She frowned momentarily.
I think I understand what went on there. And I guess it's for the best. Got to adjust, I suppose. Anyway, like I said, you're always welcome back.
Mrs. Thompson turned to go, walked 2 paces, then paused. She half turned to look back at Gordon. For a moment, her face betrayed a hint of confusion and wonder.
You aren't really a postman, are you?
She asked suddenly. Gordon smiled. He set the cap, with its bright brass emblem, on his head.
If I bring back some letters, you'll know for sure.
She nodded, gruffly, then set off up the ruined asphalt road. Gordon watched her until she passed the first bend, then he turned about to the west and the long downgrade toward the Pacific. 8. The barricades had been long abandoned. The Baffle Wall on Highway 58 at the east end of Oak Ridge had weathered into a tumbled tell of concrete debris and curled, rusting steel. The town itself was silent. This end, at least, was clearly long abandoned. Gordon looked down the main street, reading its story. 2, possibly 3 pitched battles had been fought here. A storefront with a canted sign, Emergency Services Clinic, sat at the center of a major circle of devastation. 3 intact panes reflected morning sunlight from the top floor of a hotel. Elsewhere, though, even where store windows had been boarded, the prismatic sparkle of shattered glass glistened on the buckled pavement. Not that he had really expected anything better, but some of the feelings he had carried with him out of Pine View had led to hopes for more islands of peace, especially now that he was in the fertile watershed of the Willamette Valley. If no living town, at least Oak Ridge might have shown other signs conducive to optimism. There might have been traces of methodical reclamation, for instance. If an industrial civilization existed here in Oregon, towns such as this one should have been harvested of anything usable. But just 20 yards from his vantage point, Gordon saw the wreckage of a gas station. A big mechanics tool cabinet lay on its side, its store of wrenches, pliers, and replacement wiring scattered on the oil-stained floor. A row of never-used tires still hung on a rack high above the service lifts. From this, Gordon knew Oak Ridge to be the worst of all possible Oak Ridges, at least from his point of view. The things needed by a machine culture were available at every hand, untouched and rotting, implying there was no such technological society anywhere near. At the same time, he would have to pick through the wreckage of 50 waves of previous looters in his search for anything useful to a single traveler like himself.
Well, I've done it before.
Even sifting through the downtown ruins of Boise, the gleaners before him had missed a small treasure trove of canned food in a loft behind a shoe store, some hoarder's stash, long untouched. There was a pattern to such things, worked out over the years. He had his own methods for conducting a search. Gordon slipped down on the forest side of the barricade baffle and entered the elder grove. He zigzagged on the off chance he had been watched. At a place where he could verify landmarks in three different directions, Gordon dropped his leather shoulder bag and cap under an autumn bright red cedar. He took off the dark brown letter carrier's jacket and laid it on top, then cut brush to cover the cache. He would go to any lengths to avoid conflict with suspicious locals, but only a fool would leave his weapons behind. There were two types of fighting that could come out of a situation like this. For one, the silence of a bull might be better. For the other, it could be worth expending precious, irreplaceable 38 cartridges. Gordon checked the pistol's action and reholstered it. His bow he carried, along with arrows and a cloth sack for salvage. In the first few houses on the outskirts, the early looters had been more exuberant than thorough. Often the wreckage in such places discouraged those who came after, leaving useful items within. He had found it true often before. Still, by the fourth house, Gordon had a poor collection to show for this theory. His sack contained a pair of boots almost useless from mildew, a magnifying glass, and two spools of thread. He had poked into all the usual and some unconventional hoarder's crannies and found no food of any sort. His Pineview jerky wasn't gone, but he had dipped down farther than he liked. His archery was better, and he had bagged a small turkey 2 days ago. Still, if he didn't have better luck gleaning, he might have to give up on the Willamette Valley for now and get to work on a winter hunting cap. What he really wanted was another haven such as Pineview. But fate had been kind enough lately. Too much good luck made Gordon suspicious. He moved on to a fifth house. The four-poster bed stood in what had once been a prosperous physician's two-story home. Like the rest of the house, the bedroom had been stripped of nearly everything but the furniture. Nevertheless, as he crouched down over the heavy area rug, Gordon thought he might have found something the earlier looters had missed. The rug seemed out of place. The bed rested upon it, but only with the right pair of legs. The left pair lay directly on the hardwood floor. Either the owner had been sloppy in placing the big oval carpet, or... Gordon put down his burdens and grabbed the edge of the rug. Phew! It's heavy. He started rolling it toward the bed.
Yes!
There was a thin, square crack in the floor under the carpet. A bed leg pinned the rug over one of two brass door hinges. A trap door. He pushed hard on the bedpost. The leg hopped and fell again with a boom. Twice more he shoved, and loud echoes reverberated. On his fourth heave, the bedpost snapped in two. Gordon barely escaped impalement on the jagged stub as he tumbled onto the mattress. The canopy followed, and the aged bed collapsed in a crash. Gordon cursed, fighting with the smothering shroud. He sneezed violently in a cloud of floating dust. Finally, regaining a bit of sense, he managed to slither out from under the ancient, moldy fabric. He stumbled out of the room, still sputtering and sneezing. The attack subsided slowly. He gripped the upstairs banister, squinting in that torturous, semi-orgasmic state that comes before a whopping sternutation. His ears rang with an extra murmur that seemed almost like voices. Next thing you'll be hearing church bells, he told himself. The final sneeze came at last in a loud, ah! Wiping his eyes, he re-entered the bedroom. The trapdoor lay fully exposed, layered under a new coating of dust. Gordon had to pry the edge of the secret panel. Finally, it lifted with a high, rusty scree. Again, it seemed as though some of the sound came from outside the house. But when he stopped and listened carefully, Gordon heard nothing. Impatiently, he bent down and brushed aside cobwebs to peer into the cache. There was a large metal box inside. He poked around, hoping for more. After all, the things a pre-war doctor might have kept in a locked chest, money and documents, would be of less use to him than canned goods stashed here in a spree of wartime hoarding. But there was nothing other than the box. Gordon hauled it out, puffing.
Good. It's heavy. Now let's hope it's not gold or any similar crap.
The hinges and lock were rusted. He lifted the haft of his knife to smash the small lock. Then he stopped abruptly. Now they were unmistakable. The voices were close. Too close.
I think it came from this house!
Someone called from the overgrown garden outside. Feet shuffled through the dry leaves. There were steps on the wooden porch. Gordon sheathed the knife and snatched up his gear. Leaving the box by the bed, he hurried out of the room to the stairwell. This was not the best of circumstances to meet other men. In Boise and other mountain ruins, there had been almost a code. Gleaners from ranches all around could try their luck in the open city, and although the groups and individuals were wary, they seldom preyed on one another. Only one thing could bring them all together, a rumor that someone had sighted a hole nest somewhere. Otherwise, they pretty much left each other alone. In other places, though, territoriality was the rule, and fiercely enforced. Gordon might be searching in some such clan's turf. A quick departure would, in any case, be discreet.
Still.
He looked back at the strongbox anxiously.
It's mine, damn it!
Boots clomped noisily downstairs. It was too late to close the trapdoor or hide the heavy treasure chest. Gordon cursed silently and hurried as quietly as he could across the upstairs landing to the narrow attic ladder. The top floor was little more than a simple A-frame garret. He had searched among the useless mementos here earlier. Now, all he wanted was a hiding place. Gordon kept near the sloping walls to avoid creaks in the floorboards. He chose a trunk near a small, gabled window, and there laid his sack and quiver. Quickly, he strung his bow. Would they search? In that case, the strongbox would certainly attract attention. If so, would they take it as an offering and leave him a share of whatever it contained? He had known such things to happen in places where a primitive sort of honor system worked. He had the drop on anyone entering the attic, although it was dubious how much good that would do, cornered in a wooden building. The locals doubtless retained, even in the middle of a dark age, the craft of fire-making. At least three pairs of booted feet could be heard now. In rapid, hollow steps, they took the stairs, skirmishing up one landing at a time. When everyone was on the second floor, Gordon heard a shout.
Hey, Carl! Look at this! What, you catch a couple of the kids playing doctor in an old bed again? Shit!
There was a loud thump, followed by the hammering of metal on metal.
Shit!
Gordon shook his head. Carl had a limited but expressive vocabulary. There were shuffling and tearing sounds, accompanied by more scatological exclamations. At last, though, a third voice spoke up loudly.
Sure was nice of that fella, finding this for us. Wish we could thank him. Ought to get to know him so we don't shoot first if we ever see him again.
If that was bait, Gordon wasn't taking. He waited.
Well, at least he deserves a warning,
the first voice said, even louder.
We got a shoot-first rule in Oak Ridge. He better scat before someone puts a hole in him bigger than the gap between a survivalist's ears.
Gordon nodded, taking the warning at face value. The footsteps receded. They echoed down the stairwell, then out onto the wooden porch. From the gable overlooking the front entrance, Gordon saw three men leave the house and walk toward the surrounding hemlock grove. They carried rifles and bulging canvas day packs. He hurried to the other windows as they disappeared into the woods, but saw no other motion, no signs of anyone doubling back from another side. There had been three pairs of feet. He was sure of it. Three voices. And it wasn't likely only one man would stay in ambush anyway. Still, Gordon was careful as he moved out. He lay down beside the open attic trapdoor, his bow, bag, and quiver next to him, and crawled until his head and shoulders extended out over the opening, slightly above the level of the floor. He drew his revolver, held it out in front of him, and then let gravity swing his head and torso suddenly downward in a fashion an ambusher would hardly expect. As the blood rushed to his head, Gordon was primed to snap off six quick shots at anything that moved. Nothing did. There was nobody in the second-floor hallway. He reached for the canvas bag, never taking his gaze from the hallway, and dropped it to clatter on the landing. The sound triggered no ambush. Gordon took up his gear and dropped to the next level in a crouch. He quickly moved down the hall, skirmish style. The strong box lay open and empty next to the bed, beside it a scattering of paper trash. As he had expected, there were such curiosities as stock certificates, a stamp collection, and the deed to this house. But some of the other debris was different. A torn cardboard container, the cellophane wrapper newly removed, colorfully depicted a pair of happy canoeists with their new collapsible rifle. Gordon looked at the weapon pictured on the box and stifled a strangled cry. Doubtless there had also been boxes of ammunition.
"Goddamn thieves!"
he thought bitterly. But the other trash almost drove him wild. Emperin with codeine, erythromycin, megavitamin complex, morphine. The labels and boxes were strewn about, but the bottles had been taken. Carefully handled, cashed and traded in dribbles, these could have bought Gordon admission into almost any hamlet. Why, he might even have won a probationary membership in one of the wealthy Wyoming ranch communities. He remembered a good doctor whose clinic in the ruins of Butte was a sanctuary protected by all the surrounding villages and clans. Gordon thought of what that sainted gentleman could have done with these. But his eyesight nearly went dim with dark tunnels of rage when he saw an empty cardboard box whose label read, "Tooth Powder."
"My tooth powder!"
Gordon counted to 10. It wasn't enough. He tried controlled breathing. It only helped him focus on his anger. He stood there, sloped-shouldered, feeling impotent to answer this one more unkindness by the world.
"It's all right. I'm alive. And if I can get back to my backpack, I'll probably stay alive. Next year, if it comes, I can worry about my teeth rotting out of my head."
Gordon picked up his gear and resumed his stalking exit out of that house of false expectations. A man who spends a long time alone in the wilderness can have one great advantage over even a very good hunter, if that hunter nevertheless goes home to friends and companions most nights. The difference is a trait in kinship with the animals, with the wilds themselves. It was something as undefinable as that which made him nervous. Gordon sensed that something was odd long before he could attribute it. The feeling would not go away. He had been retracing his steps toward the eastern edge of town, where his gear was cached. Now, though, he stopped and considered. Was he overreacting? He was no Jeremiah Johnson to read the sounds and smells of the woods like street signs in a city. Still, he looked around for something to back up his unease. The forest was mostly western hemlock and big-leaf maple, with alder saplings growing like weeds in nearly every former open area. It was a far cry from the dry woodlands he had passed through on the east side of the Cascades, where he had been robbed under the sparse ponderosa pines. Here there was a scent of life richer than anything he remembered since before the three-year winter. Animal sounds had been scant until he stopped moving, but as he kept still, A flow of avian chatter and movement soon began to flow back into this patch of forest. Gray-feathered camp robbers flitted in small groups from spot to spot, playing guerrilla war with lesser jays for the best of the tiny, bug-rich glades. Smaller birds hopped from branch to branch, chirping and foraging. Birds in this size range had no great love for a man, but neither did they go to great lengths to avoid him, if he was quiet.
And why am I nervous as a cat?
There was a brief snapping sound to his left, near one of the ubiquitous blackberry thickets about 20 yards away. Gordon whirled, but there, too, there were birds. Correction. A bird. A mockingbird. The creature swooped up through the branches and landed in a bundle of twigs Gordon guessed to be its nest. It stood there like a small lordling, haughty and proud. Then it squawked and dove toward the thicket again. As it passed out of sight, there was another tiny rustle. Then the mockingbird swooped into view again.